This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with the Pontiff of the Pick 4, Jude Feld. And we are once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and welcoming everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet, all there for you at horseracingradio.net. And Jude, we did a little bit of a research project the other day and realized that listeners in 165 countries have made the Horse Racing Radio Network their home for racing coverage here in 2015. So can't thank everybody enough for tuning in and going back and listening to these shows on our podcast archives or whatever it might be. We are just overwhelmed with that response here in 2015.
Yeah, I didn't even know there were 165 countries.
I didn't either. I believe that the total is somewhere around the 200 mark.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we got to get out to those other 45.
We have to, yeah. Which ones are we missing?
35, I guess it would be. Yeah, I don't know. That's crazy. That's wonderful, though. Unbelievable.
I didn't check to see how many Mongolians were tuned in on Saturday.
There must have been a few. Definitely a few Mongolians. There were plenty of them at the Breeders' Cup, that's for sure.
Well, we're going to visit with trainer Malcolm Pierce on the program here tonight. He has done a tremendous job in his career, and looking forward to this visit over the course of the next hour. Do want to remind you that if you miss any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do that, Horse Racing Radio Network, on iTunes. But Jude, very quickly, before we welcome Malcolm to the program, this past week, it was announced right before Breeders' Cup, actually, that we lost one of the premier trainers that we had in the game for a very long time, and that's Wally DeLossi, and somebody I know that you knew from being out in California for a long time.
Yeah, Wally had an amazing career, had trained horses a little bit when his kids were growing up, but once they got old enough to work at the barn, he started back in again and just won lots of races. Very nice man. His wife, Cincy, a great lady, and Wally was sick for a while, and I know it was hard on his family, but he's in a better place now, and just a real pleasure to know Wally DeLossi.
Yeah, and he will be missed by everybody in the racing world, and our thoughts and prayers going out to his entire family. Malcolm Pierce has been so good for quite a long time now. He was born in Ireland, but moved to Ontario, Canada with his family when he was just 2 years old. To date, he has saddled 570 career winners. His runners have earned nearly $35 million in purses. And Malcolm is nice enough to be with us here tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here and looking forward to hearing your story. And, it's not unusual to see trainers that are born in Ireland come here to the United States and have a lot of success. It seems to be kind of a recurring pattern, but so much of your success has come north of the border there in Canada. Take me back to the beginning. Where did Malcolm Pierce first get hooked on thoroughbred racing?
Well, in my teens, I was with the Show Jumpers and was lucky enough to learn how to ride and everything from a man named Moffat Dunlop, who was on the Canadian equestrian team. And that's where I had met Jim Day, who was also on the Canadian equestrian team at the same time. So I guess it was my early 20s. I decided I needed to go to the racetrack because I was going not any further in the show game. So I gave Jim Day a call, and he was my first job on the racetrack. And I worked for him and Sampson Farms for about 15 years.
Well, he's had such great success on the racetrack, and of course Sampson Farms a legendary operation out of Canada. So you kind of started near the top, huh?
Exactly. I think, you know, there was a few big outfits. King Haven Farm at the time were a big rivalry, but no, the Sampson Farms has always bred good horses, and I was lucky enough to be around good horses right from the start of my time on the racetrack.
What do you remember about those first days when you walked into there and you're, you know, kind of new to that side of the business? What do you remember about those early days, Malcolm?
Well, it took a while for everybody to warm up to me, but it was quite different the way things were done. You know, everything, you got your horses out, and from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., it was a, you know, whereas on the farm with the show horses, you could do it all day. You go for lunch and come back and ride the rest of them in the afternoon, whereas, you know, the racetrack is very regimented, and it needs to be run, you know, on a schedule, and the horses are quite a bit different too. You know, the stallions are livelier, and it was a different breed of horse that I started working with when I was like 21 or 22.
You said it was you weren't exactly well received. Do you find that when people come to the racetrack from the show business, they're kind of looked down upon a little bit? That's kind of been my experience.
Yes, no, I definitely. I think it just took a while for people to warm up and get to know me, and you know, because I was new and I advanced fairly quickly. I started, you know, walking some horses and mucking some stalls, and it wasn't very long I was galloping racehorses, and that was a whole new experience from the show horses to a horse that pulls you around, and I probably was run off with once or twice. And then, you know, it was only within 2 years I was Jimmy's assistant. They'd opened a farm in Ocala, and his old assistant went down to Florida to run that farm. So I took over from walking on the racetrack. Within 2 years, I was an assistant trainer for a big operation.
For people that may not be familiar with the name Jim Day, talk about him for a moment and what that was like being around him and learning from him.
Well, Jim ran a tight ship and a very good show. I mean, everything was, you know, the horses were always well turned out, or they went back to the barn, and, you know, to get a piece of straw out of their tail, they never went to the racetrack unless they were in perfect order. And, you know, he had some great horses, you know, Dance Smartly, Sky Classic, Regal Intention, you know, the list goes on, Wilderness Song, anyway, but... No, Jim, I learned a lot from Jim, and I'd say I run my show today a lot like the way he ran his 20 years ago.
That attention to detail, I think, is a hallmark of all top trainers. I mean, and it's interesting to hear you say, you know, he'd call the horses back to the shed row if they had a piece of straw in their tail. I saw Bobby Frankel do that like a gazillion times.
Yeah.
And it's that attention to detail. You obviously have that in your operation too. Talk about some of the things you learned from Jim.
Well, I mean, just how to run the shed row and, you know, how to train the horses. I mean, they're all different. They're individuals. Some horses can take a little more pressure than others. Some of the fillies that, you know, if they back out of their feed tub, you back off their training a little bit, or you space breezes out before a horse has ever had its first start. You know, you see little signs of the horse telling you that maybe I'm not ready to run yet. Maybe my fitness is right, but my mind's not right. So, you know, just learning to listen to the horses is probably what I learned most from Jimmy.
Is there a difference, Malcolm, in listening to a thoroughbred racehorse as opposed to when you were working with the show horses and trying to listen to their idiosyncrasies?
Yeah, there is a difference. I mean, they never have to, the show horses don't perform at the level the racehorses do. And, you know, for that minute and a half race or whatever, I mean, they give their all, and you really have to have them. To win, you have to have them at their best. You can't be 90% or 85%. You need to be 100% when you lead one over there in the afternoon. And, you know, we all lose more races than we win. If you win one out of five, you're winning 20% of the time, and that's considered good. But, you know, we strive to try to have our horses perform the best. And there's lots of disappointments. But, you know, when I enter a horse and lead him over to the paddock, I am hoping that I have him in the best possible order for that horse to perform at his best.
And sometimes that's hard to explain to clients too, that they're going to lose more races than they win, because they have a hard time with that. how do you manage the clients?
Well, my people are very good. I'm mostly Sampson Farms now, and I have a few horses for Pin Oak Stable in Versailles, Kentucky. And those people have been in the business long enough now that they understand totally. I mean, you have to make the phone call the morning of the race day and say, you know, your filly has a temperature, or I think he was walking unsound this morning, and we're going to have to scratch and, you know, regroup for another day. So with people that I work for, or that I train for, that have been in the business that long, they're quite understanding. I mean, it might be upset for 5 minutes, but they understand that we're doing the right thing for their horses.
Yeah, it's a huge asset. And the folks at Pin Oak are huge supporters of what we do here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't know the folks at Sampson Farm quite as well as we do the folks at Pin Oak, but Sampson Farms, when you think about their legacy and everything they've been part of, especially with Canadian racing, it has to be quite an honor, Malcolm, to be involved with that operation.
Oh, for sure. After I left Sampson in, I think it was 1997, and went out on my own and had a few different clients, and it's really just been about the last 4 or 5 years that I've been back associated with Sampson, and it's a thrill to train their horses because they've got a great broodmare band, and, you know, they try to send those broodmares to the best stallions money can get them to, and which in turn tries to, pretty much you get very nice young horses and to develop for them.
Yeah, they kind of they had a dispersal or something a few years ago, and now it seems like they're getting back in a big way. How did that all work?
Yeah, well, they didn't really have a dispersal. They weeded out some of the brood mares and they scaled back a little bit. They were kind of losing interest, but you know, now we've got a nice group of horses, especially this year. Right now, I think they're leading money owners at Woodbine for the season. And that sparks their interest. And, you know, when you can win some races and win some good races, you know, their enthusiasm is getting a little better. And we try to keep a broodmare band of about 25. And, you know, so we start with 19 or 20 young 2-year-olds every season.
So you have a kind of a major say in the operation and how it all works. Is that correct?
Well, in the training part of it, I don't get involved in the farms as far as the brood mares and the raising the babies until they come to me at 2 years old. They have a farm here in Canada where all the mares are foaled, and they have a farm in Ocala, Florida, where all the young horses grow up and get broke and get up to the stage where they're ready to come to me. So the horses are, you know, they're well taken care of and they're well schooled and, you know, well broke by the time I see them.
Malcolm Pierce visiting with us on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Malcolm, what did your parents think of you getting involved with thoroughbreds after spending so much time with show horses?
They really weren't sure, but it was time I decided I needed to make a good living. And, you know, in the show horses, it's more of a wealthy game, whereas I thought there was a better chance to earn a living training racehorses. So they were happy. They were, you know, they weren't upset that I made the transition.
Did they come from a horse background or a horse racing background?
Not really. My father was more of a, you know, he'd had workhorses and stuff to plow the fields, but he was more of a cattleman and, you know, had milking cows and beef cows. And he was more, we were on the dairy farm next door to where I learned to ride. So that's kind of how it became a part.
You, your horses appear all over the country. What's the circuit now that you follow during the year?
Well, we just started last year, starting to go to Palm Meadows in Florida and racing at Gulfstream. So for many years, I raced in Louisiana at the fairgrounds all winter and quite enjoyed that. It's probably a little bit easier racing than Gulfstream or a little less competition. But with the farm being in Ocala, it works better for me to be 3 hours away than 10 hours away because, you know, after races, we can rotate horses back and forth. So we do that for the winter months, and then we'll stop at Keeneland and race some in April on the way back to Woodbine and be back here for the start or a couple of weeks into the season. And you know, Woodbine's my home base and where I have a house and where we do most of our racing here at Woodbine.
Malcolm, when you were involved with Jim Day and you were assisting him in those early days, you had the chance to be involved with the campaigns of Triple Crown winners Regal Intention and Dance Smartly. Two really big names, especially in Canadian racing. Tell me about those experiences.
Oh, they were wonderful experiences. I mean, Dance Smartly might have been the best horse that I've ever been able to work around. She probably is. Maybe her and Chief Bearheart were Breeders' Cup winners in their time. But, no, it was just a pleasure. And, I mean, just learned watching those horses breeze would make your mouth water. And just we did a lot of traveling, obviously. And I was away a lot and gained a lot of experience traveling with those kind of horses, too.
How about when they finally did pull off that Triple Crown win? We've talked a lot about that with trainer Bob Baffert this year, with everything he went through with American Pharoah. How about with you being part of that? What was that like?
Oh, it was thrilling. I mean, very, very exciting. And just being a part of it, even though I was only the assistant, I got my little percentage. And it's, you know, it was a very nice bonus at the end of the season. And, you know, it makes you proud to just be able to be associated with those horses, whether you're the trainer, the assistant, or the groom, or the hot walker. It just picks everybody's head up.
Yeah, it's always a team effort, and you know, it doesn't matter what your piece of the pie is, what the piece of action that you're responsible for, but you got to take, you know, some pride in your work, and obviously you were a big part of that.
Oh, definitely. You know, everybody worked together, and we had a great team when those kind of horses were around here, when Samson was at its peak. I would say Dance Smartly's year, I think she went unbeaten 7-for-7 and finished out by winning the Billy and Mare Distaff at Churchill that fall.
Malcolm, at the end of 1997, you decide to do this on your own. And you said, hey, I can handle this on my own. I'll go out and make a name for myself. What led to that decision, and was it a difficult one?
No, it was just, it was, the timing was right. I had got an offer from Gary and Mary West to train 25 horses for them. And, you know, I said, well, the timing's right. I'm ready for a change and I'm ready to try this on my own. So, you know, it was a very good job, and they gave me the opportunity that I thought it was finally time to take. It was the right opportunity.
Where did you have their horses? At Woodbine?
No, we raced. Actually, I went to the U.S. We raced in Kentucky and New Orleans in the wintertime, and we had a fairly successful summer at Monmouth Park, my first season with them.
Wow, talk about falling into it at the top level with owners like Gary and Mary West. That had to be pretty special.
Yes, no, I met with the Wests at the Breeders' Cup after Chief Bearheart had won out there. I happened to be out in California for that race, and I had a meeting with Gary West after that, and they offered me a position that I thought would suit.
You know, oftentimes trainers will come on this program, Malcolm, and they'll talk about getting started and having to hustle to get clients and how difficult those early days were to get started. And even though you were starting with Gary and Mary West, I'm sure there were still some challenges that those early days presented. Is that true?
Oh, for sure. I mean, just putting a crew together, you know, walking away from the people that I'd worked with for years, that had worked under me, the grooms and everybody at Samson, it was hard to walk away. But and like I say, there were some hard times. At least they weren't financially hard times, because the Wests were very good about getting me set up with equipment and all that stuff. It was basically a private job for Gary and Mary West when I started.
Do you prefer private to public?
Yes, there's just not many of those jobs left anymore.
yeah, we know that.
Yeah, no, nobody, no, there's no, I don't think there are any private jobs left anymore. But, you know, it was great for me to get started, because I didn't have a big fund to, you know, to buy the wall boxes and the foot lockers and the bandages and the blankets. And the West did all that on a private scale and got me on my feet for the first 3 years.
Yeah, people don't realize how expensive it is, and then the trainer always has to put up the first month's worth of training, and then actually it ends up being at least 45 days before you get paid. It's a tremendous cash outlay to have just one horse. When you have 25, it's ridiculous.
Exactly. No, yeah, you wait 30 days to send a bill out, and then you might wait almost 30 days, you're right, to get paid.
So you got roughly $6,000 per horse times 25. It's a, you better have some cash in the bank or a banker that understands the business.
Yes, yeah, and people that are, and I've been very, very lucky with all the clients I've had over the years. I've trained horses. They've always been very good payers, and you know, I've never had any issues that way with any owners, and I've had quite a few over the years.
You know, that's another good point that often gets overlooked by, I think, the casual fans and people that don't understand what a trainer's job is all about, Malcolm, is the fact that you're, as much as you're training horses, you're running your own business, and there's a business aspect to all of this as well, and keeping all of those things straight, all the billing straight. How do you do that?
Well, my wife's a big help with all that. She does my billing for me, and she sees what comes in. Like, we got to pay the hay man and the grain man, and you know, we pay everybody, and then we send the bills out to get reimbursed from the owners. And it is a big process, and she spends a couple of hours every day at her desk just keeping things straight for that, so at the end of the month she's ready to send the bills out. So she's a big help, and also assists me in the training of the horses in our stable.
Yeah, what do they say? Behind every good man is a great woman. and I know your wife Sally's been with you a long time. How did that relationship come about? Was she a racetracker?
No, we met actually from the show horses that sat long ago when we were teenagers. So been together a long time, and it's worked out well so far.
Did she like the idea of you making that move from show horses to thoroughbreds?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and a couple of years later, she followed me here.
No, it's great if you can get along with your wife and have her work with you at the barn. I think it's because it's such a time consuming thing, it gives you a little bit of extra time to spend with somebody that you enjoy their company, hopefully.
oh, definitely. And I mean, it's just, they understand if it was a wife that worked in an office 5 days a week, and you know, the hours we put in at the racetrack, me getting up at 4:30 in the morning and she gets to lay in bed till 9 or 10, it wouldn't work very well. So she understands, and she doesn't want my part of the job of, you know, dealing with owners and dealing with help and stuff. And she has her duties and I have my duties, and it works well. We stay out of each other's hair.
Yeah, and it has to be a huge asset to have somebody involved with your operation that understands what you have to go through with this profession, Malcolm.
Exactly. No, it's a very big help, and I think that's why it works for us. We pay attention to detail together, and if I miss something, she might pick it up, and vice versa.
All right, so you mentioned getting up at 4:30 every morning, which makes me cringe, by the way, just so you know. I love the game, and I love being out there, but 4:30 is a little bit early. Take me through a day in the life of a horse trainer.
Well, I'm at the barn here by between 5 and 5:15 every morning, 7 days a week, and our first set of horses, usually a set of a group of about 5 or 6 horses, we head out to the racetrack at 10 to 6 and hit it when it first opens at 6 a.m. We usually have about 6 sets, which takes us till 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning to get all the horses out, trained, and cooled out. And then you've got you sit down and you plan what you're going to do with the horses the next day. You know, which ones are working, which ones are walking, which ones are got to be entered for races. So that takes you till about noon before you can get out of the barn. And then if you're racing that afternoon, it means running home for a quick shower, a change of clothes, and back to the races to saddle some horses in the afternoon. And, you know, a lot of times it's a 12 or 13 hour day before it's over. And then you think about getting some supper and going to bed.
Yeah, it can be quite a grind, especially when you have a lot of horses. It can take its toll on you on a daily basis, but there's something about the morning time that just is so great that you get drawn to the track. Do you find that? I mean, you can't wait to get out of bed in the morning?
Especially when you walk in the barn and you're looking down the shed and you're trying to say, well, that horse is going to run in the stake next week. That one's going to run in the stake 2 weeks from now. Instead of wondering whether you should enter them for 12, 5, or 16 claiming, that sure helps a lot to have a barn of good horses.
Yeah, even one, it really helps.
Yeah, you know, something to look forward to. I'm anxious to get to the barn in the morning to see a horse, like, you know, like a Dance Smartly or You know, I have a had a nice horse here. It was champion 3-year-old up with the birds. I mean, you can't wait to the in the morning to get to the barn and see him with his head out over the screen waiting for you to walk through the door.
Yeah, people like Mike that like to sleep, and like my wife, she enjoys her Z's as well. They don't get it. I mean, I haven't trained horses since 2000, but I still wake up at 4:30 every morning, and there's lots of mornings where I'll zip out to Keeneland and, you know, sit with the clockers and watch some horses breeze and stuff. I just love the morning time, and I love the fact that all the horses are champions in the morning. I mean, there's like no pressure to be around the horses in the morning. In the afternoon, they got to produce, or, you know, everybody can see the next day in the newspaper that your horse ran lousy, but in the morning, they're all good.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of hard work goes into it, but it's very, very satisfying when that horse crosses the wire first in the afternoon for you.
Malcolm Pierce, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't forget, we're with you right here until 7 o'clock Eastern Time with this visit tonight, and you can catch us every single Wednesday night from 6 to 7 Eastern here on Trainer Talk. Malcolm, what do you consider to be your first really big break?
Well, I guess when I went out on my own and just having the luxury of having to be able to train good horses for the West, you know, that was my biggest break for myself. And then probably getting hooked back up with Sampson Farms a few years ago is probably my next big break in life.
Well, Sampson Farms is a big break for a lot of people, or at least it would be a big break for a lot of trainers that could get involved with that operation. And we talked earlier about the stature of Sampson Farms and being involved with an operation like that. And I'd imagine there's got to be days, Malcolm, where you wake up and just pinch yourself.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I'm glad I'm in the later years of my career than just starting out the way things are in the business at nowadays. But, yeah, no, I'm... They breed good enough horses that at any time we can come up with a champion or a Queen's Plate winner or a horse that's good enough for us to show up at the Breeders' Cup with. And I know I have that opportunity every season with the new group of two-year-olds coming along.
How many horses do you have in your barn now?
Right now I have about 12. I have some on the way to Florida, but our season, I think I'm going to be done racing by this weekend. I've entered one for Saturday this morning, and that's probably my last runner at Woodbine for the season. And then we'll get down to Florida and gear up for the start of the Gulfstream meet a little bit.
We'll continue this visit with Malcolm Pierce in the second half of the program. Stay with us. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. For your best chance at success, shop Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Annually ranked at the top of all major North American sales by percentage of Grade 1 winners and graded stakes winners produced, that trend continued at the 2015 Breeders' Cup World Championships. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales grads won 6 Breeders' Cup races at Keeneland, with victories by such stars as American Pharoah, Stop Charging Maria, Songbird, Nyquist, Teppan, and Waybell Avenue. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Where will you be? For more information, please visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossellmeyer,
what a finish to the class. And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Kale Density announces a revolutionary gastrointestinal guard and aid for all classes and all ages of horses. A natural registered animal feed product, it comes as a single dose disposable syringe or a handy top dress squeeze pouch. Field trials on Kale Density Digestive Aid have returned 100% favorable results as observed by their trainers and owners, and the cost is half of what horsemen are accustomed to paying. Kale Density Digestive Aid will be available in mid-November, or you can order online at kaledensity.com. Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Jack Milton down inside. It's a little bit tight for him. In behind a wall of horses, Admiral Kitten as the field turns for home. Joha now in front. Get in line, gives way. Joha, Stormy Len, not a capital llama. And up with the birds is coming with a flying finish. And on the far outside, Admiral Kitten coming on too. Jack Milton has gotten through on the rail. They're coming down to the finish. And it is the Canadian up with the birds. Admiral Kitten, late surge. Up with the birds, won it. He won it by a neck. Admiral Kitten was second. Jack Milton was third.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington studios. And want to remind you that if you did miss any portion of this show, well, all you have to do is go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows available for you to scroll through and listen to at your leisure. You can also do that, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Malcolm Pierce is our special guest tonight. We told you at the beginning of the program that he's had a tremendous amount of success since going out on his own. He has saddled 570 career winners, more than $35 million in purses. And Jude, a big part of that is a little horse by the name of Up With The Birds. And we just heard the call of the Jamaica Handicap, and he was so sensational in winning that day. The lone grade one so far in the career of Malcolm Pierce.
Well, he's a really, really nice horse, and you know, Malcolm did a great job with him. I always thought he had the potential to be any kind of horse. Obviously, a Grade One winner's good enough, but I thought he could even maybe exceed that. Win something major like a Breeders' Cup when he was younger, and I guess he never really panned out after leaving Malcolm's barn.
Well, Malcolm, I can tell you this. When you bring up the name Jamaica Handicap and you look back on that 2013 renewal, that has to bring up some amazing memories for you.
Oh, that was a thrilling day. I flew down and on a private jet with the owners to New York to saddle the horse. And, just him winning that race, I mean, I thought we had a chance, but to win it was probably one of the most special races, or it is the most special race I've won so far in my career.
Yeah, to notch a grade one, and as you mentioned, your lone grade one victory to this point anyways, I'm sure there's many more to come, but to actually break through in a race like that, what does that mean to a trainer?
Well, I mean, it's you had the horse, we thought he should have won the Queen's Plate that year, but he had some bad luck. The weather turned to torrential downpours, and the track turned into a speed-favoring track, and he's the type of a horse that likes to come from off the pace, so it was a big disappointment to not win the Queen's Plate that year, but for him then to go into New York and win a Grade One, it was extra special, and I thought maybe he's going to get the recognition that he deserves, because we always thought a lot of that horse. Once he started racing, he was a very nice horse, and he actually took us to Japan the fall, but it didn't work out very well over there in the Japan Cup. But anyway, he gave me a big thrill in New York.
Talk about that, the traveling and the people that you meet along the way. I think that's one of the beauties of our sport is that, you know, an average person can get involved in thoroughbred racing, and then the whole world kind of opens up to them.
Definitely. I mean, I've been at a lot of racetracks around the country, you know, in and out for the day. I've seen the airport and the racetrack, you know, just to go in and saddle a horse. But you do meet people, other trainers in the barn where you stable, and, you know, you make a lot of friends along the way. And if someone was to send a horse up here to Woodbine, I'll help them out. I'll loan them a stall and some help to take care of their horse. And it works both ways. And then if I send a horse to Chicago, I'll have a friend of mine there, you know, that'll provide a stall and help. And it's always nice to be in somebody's barn that you know.
How'd you like Japan?
I loved it. I thought it was a great trip for the people. They couldn't have treated us any better. But I thought it was a very tough trip. You need a special, special horse to go over there with nerves of steel. There's absolutely no medication, no Lasix. So like I say, it takes a special horse to handle the crowd and the race day atmosphere there. But we couldn't have been treated any more royally.
Did you notice a difference with the birds when you got him over there?
You know, he acted good, and he's always been a good traveler and doesn't need the medication, Lasix. I mean, we don't have any excuses that he bled or anything on us, but he came kind of unnerved because by the time he left his stall to the time he walked in the gate was well over an hour. It was probably the best part of 90 minutes, and he handled the first half of it and the saddling paddock and everything good, but with no pony out on the racetrack and all that time in front of 120,000 people, I could see him starting to get nervous and sweaty, and I was thinking that, you know, he's probably going to leave his race behind the gate that day, and I totally think that's what happened.
You know, we've never had the chance to go to Japan for the races over there, but so many people tell me that it's a different type of experience. What's different about racing in Japan than here in the United States?
Well, I guess just the amount of people that come out, that was probably their biggest day of the Japan Cup, but I'm sure if there was one, there was 120,000 people in those stands and the noise, and that we even put earplugs in our horse to try to keep him calm before the race. And it's just, you know, it's a little different. I mean, our horses are used to going with a pony in post parade and calming them down and stuff. Whereas there they walk in a circle behind the gate, and it's something totally new for the horse. And that's why I think you need one with nerves of steel. And it'd be like going to the Kentucky Derby, be my best example.
Yeah, it seems like there's always a lot of commotion at Japanese races, like bands and parades and flaming dragons and all of that. It's got to be a little bit unnerving for the horses. We talked to Richard Mandela a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling us whenever you ship out of town, you have no control over all the little things that the horses will see, whereas at home, you know, when they dump the trash cans, you know where all the pitfalls are on your way to the paddock, and you can adjust for those things. But when you're out of town, you're kind of at their mercy.
Yes, and it's a big travel to get there. Like, we had to van our horse from Toronto to Chicago to get on an airplane for 15 hours to get to Japan. So that was the first time he'd ever flown, and that's a new experience. I mean, I handled it all well, and I thought he was going into the race in good order. I just think the length of the post parade and the crowd finally got to him in the last 15 minutes before the race.
If you had to do it again, would you try to ship in earlier so you have more time to recover, or what adjustments would you make now that you've had that experience?
I would want to make sure I had a very, very special horse in my barn. I'd love to go back and see Japan again, but, you know, once might have been enough for me. It'd be the same as, you know, Dubai and those places. I'm sure it's a great experience to go over there, but I think you need I'd want to make sure I had a horse that you could let a bomb off beside him and he wouldn't flinch to go over and handle those kind of days and those big races. And that's why the better horses win those races, because they have got nerves of steel.
How did you handle that journey to Japan, Malcolm?
Not too bad. I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning every day because I never adjusted to the time change. And the only English channel in our hotel was CNN. So it was a little different. But no, I mean, it was a whirlwind trip. I was only there for 5 days. And like I say, never adjusted to the time change whatsoever, but an experience I'll never forget.
How about the food?
Food was good. Food was good. They even had a TGI Fridays down the street from the hotel.
Oh, now you're talking Mike's language.
Go all the way to Japan and eat at a TGI Fridays. That is exactly what I would do.
We definitely tried the culture and had some Chinese meals and stuff. Most of them were Japanese.
Right. Malcolm Pierce here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Malcolm, in 2014, Up With The Birds has yet another signature win in the Grade 2 Nijinsky there at Woodbine, and I can imagine that day had to be pretty amazing.
Yes, no, it was good to get another win under his belt, and he ran fairly well in the Arlington Million, but anytime you win, like I say, with a big horse, to come back from his three-year-old year and win a stake race, we were proud of him that day too.
How about this? Before he wins the Jamaica Handicap in 2013, I can remember being at Keeneland, or maybe it was right after that, but it was the Pin Oak Valley View, and I was invited by Mrs. Abercrombie and by Clifford Berry to be in their suite for the Pin Oak party that they have every year at Keeneland for the Valley View. And Malcolm, you were fortunate enough to saddle the winner of that race by the name of Overheard, and he was owned by the folks at Pin Oak, and I can remember the celebration that went on in that suite after that victory. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that was very – anytime you can win a race that's sponsored by your owner, it was very exciting, and like I say, I was lucky enough to be there that day too, and Mrs. Abercrombie was very, very happy. That was a lovely filly in her own right, Overheard. She just retired this fall and has gone to the breeding shed, and she's at Pin Oak right now waiting for the spring to be bred.
What a great lady Mrs. Abercrombie is, and she's got to be just a treat to train for.
Absolutely wonderful. They're fantastic people. Her general manager, Clifford Berry, you couldn't have somebody easier to deal with, and he's been there for a very long time, I'm assuming like 25 years working for her, and he's great to deal with, and he tries to pick me out the odd good young horse every year to send to Woodbine, and they're super people to train for as well.
Do you find that when you have a horse that's owned by the sponsor of the race, like that with the Pin Oak Valley View, I won't call it pressure, because the pressure is probably always the same, but is there an extra desire on your part, Malcolm, to really want to win that race for them?
Oh, definitely. Unfortunately, we sent a filly down the same this year for the same race with a filly called Don't Leave Me, who has run well and was a multiple stakes winner. And, thinking she's got a pretty good chance going into the race, but that was the way the reins opened up. And actually, they took the race off the turf, and we took a bad gamble and let her run anyway, and she ran up the track. But Mrs. Abercrombie understood that just as well as winning it. Can't happen all the time.
Yeah, well, if you do it once, that's got to be a great feeling. So, but there'll be more. They breed some nice horses over there.
I sure hope so. I've had a very nice filly for them this year. She's still a maiden. It's run twice, but I've got high hopes for her to develop into a nice 3-year-old. Maybe we'll be back there next fall for the same race with her.
Malcolm, let's walk back to your very first graded stakes win, and that was in 2000 with a horse by the name of Super Red. Tell me about that day.
Yeah, well, that was a horse that I trained for the Stronix, for Stronix Stables, and he was a very neat little horse, and another thrilling day. Anytime you can win a race, it's a thrill to me, and never mind any stake race is even more thrilling. So, but no, I was very blessed with Mr. Stronic. Had me train 12 or 13 horses for him for a couple of years, and we did quite well. We won some nice races, and was hoping we could win the Queen's Plate for him for a little horse with a little horse called Rock Again, but unfortunately he got hurt in the race and never got to be the horse that we thought he was.
Do you remember a horse that you trained named Lean On Me?
I do.
Well, he.
I don't.
She
I don't
was.
Remember a whole lot about her.
She was very important to the Horse Racing Radio Network. It was the day of the Louisiana Derby, And Mike was getting killed at the windows. I think it was 2007. Yeah. And I was having a pretty good day. Circular Key had won the Louisiana Derby. And Mike was stuck a lot of money. And he was a little nervous to go home and tell his wife what he lost. So he said, "Do you like anything the rest of the card?" And I said, "I love Malcolm Pierce's horse in the next race." And so he went to the ATM, got some money, and got out for the day. I made a major wager, and we talk about that race at least three or four times a year. So you may not remember, but we've never forgotten it.
You may have saved my marriage, Malcolm.
Well, I'm glad for that.
Yeah, just a really cool moment for us, huh?
Yeah, it was great. I was watching Imogene Wilson come down the stretch on this gray filly and paid like $25 or something. It was fantastic. And I've always said that you're like the friend of the better. A lot of times your horses get overlooked, and I don't know why, because you're such a good trainer. But your horses often pay good prices, and I always circle your name in the past performances when I see you've got one in.
Well, I've started to do a little better with my first-time starters. I used to be known for never having one ready to win first time out, and this year we've had a lot of first time out winners, and I don't think I'm doing anything different. I think we've gotten lucky and maybe hooked the right fields, or I don't know what the reason is, but now I don't know what they're going to say, because we've won with more first timers this season probably than the last five or six put together.
Is that important, Malcolm, for a trainer to be good or have a good winning percentage with first-time starters?
I don't really think so. I mean, I'm not one to put all – I don't want my horse's first race to be the best race of their career, you know. Some horses that are just that talented, they can even get left at the gate and win in spite of some mistakes that were made along the way. You know, I think that's just – I've had a lot of good three-year-old fillies that just happened to win first-time out this year because they're good horses.
Yeah, that's always it's always a good sign when a trainer who's not particularly known for first-time starters has one perform well first time out. That usually indicates that the horse really has a lot of ability.
Yes. No, a couple of the fillies we've had this year, like Southern Ring for one, she went on. She got beat her first start, actually, but she ended up going home Hero Stakes winner after three or four starts, I think, this season. So, you know, I thought she was a very good horse before she ever ran, and anyway, when they can win first time out, they're usually special if they come out of my barn.
Well, since we're talking about percentages, so many trainers that I've talked to have told me that once winning percentages began being published in past performances, whether it's Racing Form, Briss, whatever it might be, it kind of changed the game for trainers. Do you agree with that, Malcolm?
I guess somewhat. I mean, in the back of your mind, you watch that. But when I think I have a horse ready to run, I'm ready to lead it over there and take a chance. I mean, it's probably the owners and the public that watch your percentage more than you do yourself. But, you don't want to just run horses for the sake of racing horses, filling races and stuff. You want to keep your percentages up. If you're a public trainer and looking for new clients, I'm sure that's what some of the owners that are looking to make a move look at. Well, this guy wins at 25%, we should have our horses with him.
Yeah, I think that's really the way that the sport has gone. That's the first place the owners look when they're trying to pick out a trainer is the, you know, standings. And unfortunately, that's the way. And sometimes, you know, just because somebody's not in the standings doesn't mean they're not a good trainer or know what they're doing or could be a tremendous asset to a stable. So it's like a marriage. You've got to find the right person that agrees with your goals and aspirations, I think, more than looking at the standings.
Yes, and no, the people I train for are more into developing a horse and, you know, worried about winning that first race or winning three in a row. They, you know, let's go through our conditions and not just jump into a stake race right off the bat after breaking your maiden. Let's develop these horses and have them around till they're 5-6 years old.
What's the key to doing that, Malcolm?
Probably not over racing them at two and giving them a break in at the end of the season. Like, that's why I'm down to a small stable at the moment here. A lot of my horses are already at the farm in Ocala having their little 30 or 45 day break and will join back up with me later in the winter to get ready for spring racing at Keeneland or even racing back at Woodbine in May.
That's a tremendous luxury to have, to be able to do that. And it's got to really be gratifying for you that you can turn horses out for the winter or however long they need to have a rest. And then when they come back, they're so much better.
Yeah, I mean, just getting them off the racetrack for, like I say, 30 to 45 days, that just helps their minds, and they can be horses again. They go out and learn paddocks and run around and not have to go through, because it's a very regimented routine we have while they're stabled at the racetrack. And as you know, they spend, 23 and a half hours a day probably in their stalls. And that's a very boring existence, and it's nice to let them be horses again for a couple of months and then start them up for a new season. And my people are also very good. If we have any little issues, let's just stop, give the horses the time. And I think that's why we have, 4 and 5 year olds still racing, and they're not done at the end of their 3-year-old year.
Do you typically notice a big change in the horses when they come back to your barn after spending a couple of months on the farm?
Oh, sure. Most of them will gain weight and just have a better attitude. They're happy to come back and get back in the routine. The horses are different. Some enjoy their farm time, and sometimes the farm trainer will tell me, Malcolm, this horse is just running the fences. I'm going to put him back in training, and he's coming back to you in 30 days. Or this one's loving the time off. I'm going to give him 60 days.
So often in the sport, we hear that horses aren't bred the way they were in the old days. They're not as strong or as tough as they were in the old days. But Malcolm, you're sitting there with 5-year-old and 6-year-old horses, so it sounds like you're kind of bucking that trend. Do you buy into that whole theory that horses today are not bred to be as strong as they used to be?
They're probably a little more fragile, I would say, but I think with our program, we try to space our races out and not race them as often. I think horses back in the day, they could run every 7 days or 2 weeks or whatever, but we try to give our horses 4 to 5 weeks between races and, let them either forget about the bad race or dwell on the win and give them time to recover to have a peak effort, because I think it's been proven over and over again, horses that run back on short rest, they're not going to run to that Byer figure or that Ragnarsson figure that they just won with if they come back in 2 to 3 weeks.
So you are you a sheets guy? Do you pay a lot of attention to the sheets?
Not really, myself. I mean, I think it's a good tool, but no, I don't. I let the horses tell me, I can come back in 3 weeks. I've bounced out of this race real good. But if a horse that runs a 10 on the rag sheets all of a sudden runs a 5, I would look to say, well, maybe this horse needs at least 4 weeks, possibly 5 weeks before we think of running him back, because that was, twice as good as his best number ever.
Malcolm Pierce on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Malcolm, when you think about the trainer colony, we'll look at it like that, in Canada, in Woodbine, and you think of names like yourself and Reed Baker and Mark Cassie and Mark Frostad, the names of the trainers there resonate with American racing fans as well. And I'm just curious to get your opinion on how strong that group of trainers is in Canada, because from our vantage point, it looks very strong.
No, they're very strong. And, I mean, you've left out a guy named Roger Atfield, who has been around for
oh, him.
Years. And won 2 stakes on the same day last weekend here. But it's a very strong group of trainers. Mark Cassie is just loaded with horses and owners that are willing to spend money. And he's been the perennial leading trainer here because nobody can run the amount of horses. And, I mean, he does a very good job, don't get me wrong, but his numbers just are, like, if I run 100 horses, he's run 400.
Yeah, he's got a huge stable right now, and winning 2 Breeders' Cup races isn't going to shrink it any, I can tell you that much.
No, he does a great job running his operation, and to have as big a stable as he has, I don't know how he has time in the day. He must eat and breathe and sleep horses.
I can remember Roger Atfield joining us on this program last year, and it was such a delight to be able to visit with him and hear his story. And I can tell you what, the guy can tell a joke or two as well.
Roger's a great guy and a good friend, and I really respect Roger as much as anybody here at Woodbine.
Malcolm, I always like to ask trainers this next question because you get so many different answers to it. But when you look back on everything you've accomplished in your entire career, what things are you most proud of?
Well, I'm proud of that. I think a lot of people like me, and I haven't made any enemies in this game. Like I say, when owners have moved along, we've always parted on good company, where if I was down and out, I think I could call a Frank Stronach up and say, you know, Frank, could you send me six horses? I really need to get back on my feet. You know, even though I don't train for him any longer, I've never burned any bridges, and I've tried to be very honest with my owners and let them know if there's a problem with a horse that, or this horse isn't, unfortunately, I don't know how much we paid for it, but it's not very good, you know, and I've just, my honesty, I guess, is what I'm most proud of in this game.
One thing I've noticed about you is that when you're in the paddock or in the walking ring, you always have a smile on your face, and you must really enjoy what you do.
I wouldn't get up at 4:30 every morning if I didn't, and I still do, and yes, I don't know how long I will do it for, but right now I still enjoy doing what I'm doing, and I enjoy being in the paddock to saddle the horses, because that's what we work all those hard mornings for, is to try to get one over there to the races and have a chance to win.
What things would Malcolm Pierce still want to accomplish in your career?
I guess a few more grade ones, or a Breeders' Cup and a Queen's Plate are still on the agenda. But, you know, you can't push too hard for those things. They'll come along. I always say things happen for a reason, and went up with the birds, got beaten the Queen's Plate here. I guess there was a reason he was second. I don't know, but I don't know what the good reason was, but we're back to try again next year.
All right, Malcolm, only a minute or two left. I always like to end by asking trainers to tell us something that people might not know about them. So when you're not at the racetrack, what things does Malcolm Pierce enjoy doing?
I like to fish. I don't get to do it as much as I'd like, obviously, with our schedule here, but I sure would. There's nothing better than a relaxing day out on a boat with some good friends, whether you're catching fish or just sitting there chatting. But a relaxing day away from the track would be for out fishing.
You like to saltwater fish or freshwater?
I really love the fishing in the brackish water in New Orleans. We'd go down to Delacroix. My good friend Dr. Jay Addison always loaned me his boat, and your limit of 25 speckled trout, and if you could catch them two at a time in an hour, that's probably my favorite fishing is there.
Wow, that would be amazing. Did you ever get David Fox to take you out on his boat?
I have not yet, but that's still on the bucket list, maybe.
put in your request when you're down there in Florida. He goes out all the time.
All right. Yeah, no, I was out once last year, but yeah, I'm not really a deep sea guy where you go on the charters and they do everything for you. They bait the hook and hook the fish and then hand you the fishing pole. That's not what I think about it.
Fox won't be doing that for you, I can guarantee
it. All right. Well, now that's my relaxing time would be fishing.
Well, Malcolm, it's been so great to hear your story here tonight, and really do appreciate you taking the time. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you'll receive a gift from one of our sponsors, that is Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those to you, and all the best moving forward, and congratulations on all your success.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Malcolm Pierce here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Great guy.
Yeah.
Fun
yeah.
visit.
It was fantastic, yeah. Really enjoyed it.
Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net, a podcast available for you to listen to at your leisure. Our thanks to Malcolm for being here with us tonight. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna, and we'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.